Greetings, and welcome to the First Foundation Wealth Management Insights webinar. Today's call is being recorded. At this time,
thank you for joining us. It's hard to believe we started doing these 8 weeks ago. I'm joined today by Rick Keller, Drew Chan, and Dan Phan. Today's format is to address some of the questions that we have been hearing from many of you. This call is designed to provide some insights into the information we are monitoring and how it is impacting your investments. We also want to spend some time today to discuss the impact of the CARES Act on retirement planning. So let's get started. Rick, the news now is very much focused on reopening America. Some of our local politicians are saying that we are now 70% open, while others are implying it will be another 3 months before we open. But no matter who is right, there is a high toll on being paid on our economy. And you've oftentimes said that none of these models take into account the economic destruction. So starting with you, Rick, has there been any analysis on the daily cost of keeping our economy shut down and the potential cost of shutting down again if we see a second wave in the fall? Is our economy strong enough to weather this?
Okay. Thank you, John, and thank you all for joining. Well, that was a long question, John, with a lot of parts.
Yeah.
But, you know, as of yet, I have not seen an analysis of the impact of remaining closed an additional day, week, or month. Unfortunately, we do start to go into a critical phase for our economy. So the what we hear, for instance, from our own governor here in California, phase two was supposed to start on Friday, May 8th, which is just minimal, but they have no date set for phase three, the next phase. So, you know, 50% of the workers in leisure and hospitality areas, hotel workers, restaurants, things like that, have been laid off. Now, they are, most are eligible to receive the unemployment insurance, but it's not 100% of them. So it's estimated that about 65 to 75% of them qualify for unemployment. The unemployment currently, it's $600 a week, works out to $15 an hour. So some of those workers may not have been paid $15 an hour. So unemployment has turned out to be profitable for them. So I'm not sure when those businesses open back up whether or not these people are going to show up until their unemployment runs out. Right now, unemployment is due to run out end of July, but I fully expect in the next bill they're going to run that through the end of the year. But we don't have a clear plan for the state of California. But like a lot of issues that affect this country or a particular state, because they're so large and diverse, that if you have clusters of virus affecting people in LA, it may not affect Palm Springs, let's say, or out in the other desert areas or in the mountainous areas or in the low density. So if you look at the map of California, all the places that look to be shut down for an extended period, they're all along the coast, San Diego County, Orange County, LA County, and the Bay Area. So unless we get these places back up and running, the impact both on the businesses and then not to mention our own state in terms of its resources with the lack of sales tax revenue, lack of hotel room revenue, and things like that, they start to take a greater and greater toll that in some cases may be irreversible for a lot of these businesses. So I think it's unfortunate, but we do need some kind of analysis done on where the critical points are that some of these businesses may have some planning to plan when they can open up, because after all, the virus in terms of an actual vaccine, maybe not until second quarter of next year, and we cannot wait that long. We will all be in such a dire depression state that there will be no recovery for a decade or more. So I'm optimistic that we get things through and do the right thing, and so that light at the end of the tunnel, even though it's clear, we still can't tell how far off it is. So, I'm really hoping it's before the end of this quarter, because, like I say, this quarter is the down quarter. We now expect the economy to contract on an annualized basis as much as 37% is the average economist tracked by Bloomberg, which is 50 economists. So if you divide that by four, we can roughly say it's approximately 10%. And we hope that is followed by an improving third and fourth quarter and pull out of this thing.
Thanks, Rick. And we've, you know, as you said, the second quarter is ugly, and we've already seen several retailers, JCPenney filing for Chapter 11, and other retailers. I think Nordstrom's announced they were closing 16 stores. So do you continue to expect more of that to come, because it seems like some of these areas that were weak before, if anything, they're in dire straits now, and so as a result, you're going to continue to see some of these shutdowns. But let me move over to Drew here. So as we take steps to return the economy, it seems like we're seeing a divergence between, as Rick said, how bad the economic data is and the performance of the stock market. The economic data is some of the worst of all time. Meanwhile, the financial markets aren't great, but they're well off their lows we saw in March. This seems to be the question we get most often asked of us. Drew, maybe you could shed some light on why this might be the case, the divergence between the economic data and the rebound of the stock market.
Great. Thanks, John. On our last call a few weeks ago, I highlighted how basically investment markets are forward-looking pricing mechanisms, and typically looking forward out about 12 months. And right now, you know, the market is looking out. And, you know, typically they're using the data that we're getting from, you know, either GDP, leading indicators, or more importantly, earnings from individual companies to make good decisions. You know, decisions to add more capital, take away capital, or to maintain capital. You know, going back to mid-March, we were basically in a blackout in terms of transparency. No one knew what a shutdown would look like. We had never gone through that before. Which businesses and sectors would be deemed essential? How long is it? You know, that's the question we're still having today, is how long the shutdown? What's the spread of infections? How many deaths? And ultimately, what would the Fed's response be for monetary policy, and what the federal government's response be for fiscal policy? This really drove both equity and fixed income markets to be dislocated. And, you know, if you think about what earnings and cash flows are, basically they disappeared too. No one really knew the impact. As many of these companies, such as Disney, you know, being forced to shut down Disneyland. So with no backstops in place, you know, that far left tail scenario, you know, kind of going back to the Great Depression, became, you know, a bigger percentage. There's fears that the full-blown liquidity or credit crisis would become into the marketplace. I think it's kind of key to note that the week we saw the S&P 500 really hit the lows, March 23rd, was also the week we saw basically things start to rebound. If you kind of think back to that week, the CARES Act was signed into a bill that Friday on March 27th, and that really restored a lot of confidence that the investment markets were kind of going slowly back to normal and healing. One of my favorite investors that I track is Howard Marks from Oak Tree Capital up in downtown Los Angeles. And one of his memos he wrote a few years ago, he wrote, "In the real world, things generally fluctuate between pretty good and not so hot. But in the world of investing, perception often swings from flawless to hopeless." And I really can't think of a better quote from what we saw from February's record highs to March's dramatic move down. So going back to looking out forward, last week was a perfect example of that. The S&P 500 was up 3.5% last week, even as we saw on Tuesday, the first quarter estimate for GDP coming in at minus 4.8% annualized. And then on Friday, we saw an amazing, astounding unemployment number. You know, that rate jump up to 14.7%, which is the highest rate and largest over the month increase since the BLS started actually tracking data back in 1948. Now, remember, this is only 2 months removed from February's 50-year low of an unemployment rate of 3.5%. Currently, there are about 23 million Americans unemployed. However, when you start peeling back the onion on that data, it shows that out of the unemployed, 78% are classify themselves as temporary unemployed, meaning that they expect to come back to their job within the next 6 months. And over the last 50 years, the three recessions with the highest share of temporary layoffs were followed by the fastest labor market recoveries.
Thanks, Drew. And maybe, you know, one of the other things we talk about oftentimes is the S&P 500 has been the best performing sector of the market. But if you look at the total market, all stocks, the Russell 2000 small cap stocks are down over 25%. Even the Dow, the difference between in returns between the Dow and the S&P is almost 6 to 7% this year. The S&P is down 12 to 13, and the Dow is down almost 20%. And so a lot of what's driven the S&P 500 has been some of these, you know, 8 to 10 large cap technology stocks. And despite the bad news on the economy, Amazon, Facebook, Google, they all seem to be growing through this. And those companies represent a bigger portion of the index today. So an Amazon, for example, might be a big part of the index, where company number 499 might only be a fraction of the index. So Amazon has a much bigger impact on the index's returns today. And so one of the things I think we did well in our stock portfolios was really focus on the bigger companies, which has definitely been the best category of performance year to date, because smaller companies have really taken it on the chin. But moving on back over to you, Rick, you talked about the states earlier, and a lot of the headlines are reading today about stimulus relief for states, as there have been cries from governors, including here in California. Anyways, we know the budgets are upside down. They're talking about potentially being insolvent by the end of the year. What are you to make of this, and how is it impacting investments such as the bond market?
Well, as I alluded to in parts of the answer in my first question, this is very real for many states, and the two you mentioned, California and Hawaii. You know, for Hawaii, the tourist business and the hotel room tax has just evaporated, right? And for California, it's our sales tax and hotel tax, and also tourism that really helps the Disneyland type companies. But, you know, you think of all the sports venues that didn't take place, and you know, they said there's a million kegs of beer that's going to rot, because they know how to drop off a full keg. They don't know how to pick up full kegs. So a lot of things to be ironed out. But I do expect the federal government to come to the rescue here. But I do think they have to take a very precise role in the allocation, because to fund a budget for police and fire would be very desirable, or school teachers, very desirable, but to fund the 100% pension plans for some police or fire captain that might get $250,000 a year, even though he's only 52 for the rest of his life, and to put away millions in that money flows through directly into the stock market. But that has absolutely no stimulus value to the economy in terms of keeping the economy afloat. So when they give these monies, just like the PPP program for small business, it's one thing to support wages for your labor costs and some of the essential costs of running your business. But it's another thing to go into longer-term funding issues that I think aren't going to have the immediate impact. So I do think the federal government's going to come out with another bill that will help the states and cities, because they are going to be, many of them, in a world of hurt, and they're not going to be able to make it on their own. And let's face it, that with the federal government's borrowing costs less than 1%, if they do have to borrow, this is the time to borrow, and we can't have these cities and states shut down all their essential services. So I think we do need to come out and help them.
Rick, and we know the Fed has announced that they would buy municipal bonds to help backstop that market, but as we know, there's thousands of bonds, muni bonds out there, and they can't, you know, the Fed can't save all bondholders, and so we've tried to focus on the highest quality munis and stay away from some of the riskier stuff. Do you think you're gonna see some bankruptcies in some of the municipal bond categories?
I hope they bail them out sooner rather than later. But as you know, a lot of the muni bond market is comprised of more private purpose bonds or revenue bonds, and let's say they're revenue bonds on a toll road, and nobody's taking the toll road. Those could get in trouble. But
Or a convention
so some
center.
Of these,
yeah.
So a lot of those types of bonds are going to be trouble. But remember, a lot of cities and municipalities are late on filing their financial statements. So usually, if you find out they're in trouble, it's way down the road. But I hope the federal government comes to the rescue sooner rather than later, because the last thing they want is a whole bunch of cities and municipalities filing bankruptcies. Right now, states can't file bankruptcy, but cities can. So, and individual projects can. But the government, the federal government, with 1% borrowing costs, has to bail out these cities and states where their borrowing costs may balloon out to extraordinary levels because of the risk that investors may be taking. And again, all of it helps put in the patchwork that we're going to need to get the economy stabilized.
Thanks, Rick. Drew, I asked this question on the last call, but want to address it again. Which sectors and segments of the economy are we most closely watching? Where are we finding value? Where are we trimming exposure?
So I think maybe just starting at a high level, to kind of piggyback on a comment you talked about, the S&P 500 is only down about 11% year to date. And I think the key thing when you look through that is peeling back the onion. Not all sectors and companies are equal. There's only one sector out of the 11 we call GIC sectors is a positive for the year, and that's information technology at about 2%. Energy is down close to 40% for the year. So a pretty dramatic range, you know, minus 40 to positive 2%. So that's one space. You know, we look at financials, probably the second worst performing sector, down plus 30% or minus 30% for the year. You know, as this time they're really being asked to help backstop and provide liquidity to Main Street and small businesses. And particularly, we've seen the large money center banks really get hit over the last few months. So I'm watching actually those two sectors very, very closely, energy and financials, given that the worst performing segments of the economy, and really just to see when flows are going to be coming back in. So typically, we like to see bottom fishers, you know, seeking deep value to help support the worst parts. And that's where we can really start to believe that the current rally is transforming into a longer-term rally. Another area is probably real estate. Real estate's down about 20% for the year. And I think long-term is still a compelling value, you know, particularly in certain subsectors within real estate, areas that are not going away. For example, we know the work-from-home equities have done really, really well over the last few months. But I don't think, you know, the entire economy will shift permanently to home shopping overnight. I think office and retail will have to reshape themselves. They're not going away, but they definitely will have to reshape themselves as they get through this. So it'd be good to see more and more momentum kind of come to the weaker sections of the economy to really help solidify that recovery is, you know, really building. I think one thing, too, is understanding that every single space is so unique. You know, we recently spoke with one of our real estate investment partners who focuses on grocery stores, you know, grocery store anchored shopping centers across the country. And they reported that 74% of their tenants made their rent payments in May. And they're actually expecting that number to increase as more and more of those shopping centers are being allowed to open up that are located in the middle of the United States. So, you know, as Rick mentioned, you know, clearly everyone's more focused right now on the economy reopening. But I think the data that a lot of people have been looking at prior with, you know, the unknowns is, you know, it's not as bad as expected across the board. You know, I think globally, it's tough. You know, we're taking those same applications, looking at country to country, sector to sector, region to region, and company to company. Every single company is on a different trajectory on how they're dealing with COVID-19. But I think right now the market continues to value transparency. As you mentioned, large caps have done much better than small caps domestically. Domestic stocks have done much better than international stocks because typically investors want to own what they can see and understand better. So at this point, we still remain, you know, overweight large cap U.S. stocks, given the transparency premium, or underweight international equities because in some cases, economic growth was already a concern prior to COVID-19, and we remain neutral on emerging market equities. As they remain a compelling story on the long term, we know through the last few years as trade tensions arose that basically the world was moving from a single consolidated supply chain to a two supply chain world, one that's focused on China and the other on the West. And the one that's going to be focused on the West needs to be rebuilt, so there could be some great long-term opportunities in select emerging markets.
Thanks, Drew. Dan, I'm going to come to you with the next question. Let's talk about retirement planning. Obviously, personal emergency funds are more important now than ever. But what are we hearing from our clients who are currently retired or facing retirement in the next couple of years? What advice can we share with those that don't have the longer-term horizon to recover from a prolonged recovery?
Thanks, John. You know, I think understandably a lot of our clients are nervous and a little anxious, but I think if anything good that came out of the last financial crisis, 2008, was teaching the lesson of staying the course and waiting for markets to recover. Obviously, John, you and Rick will have a better idea of how to explain that and how that's happened in the past, but in general, they're patient, and I think that's a good thing. But this time's a little different in light of the fact that that was quite a while ago, and now, given fast forward to today, their time horizon for retirement may have shrunk. But the one thing that we've done, and one thing that we always encourage our clients to do with us and we're happy to do for them, is a cash flow analysis that we take a qualitative approach, look at the resources you have, the income coming in, your expenses, and your goals as far as what you want to do in the expense process going forward, and do a qualitative analysis, a cash flow analysis, and kind of see where you're at. And a lot of clients have asked us, the ones that we've done one before this happened, to rerun it and see what happens now. And maybe it's a relationship to what Drew mentioned, that overall performance in certain sectors hasn't been as bad as you would think. In general, if they were on track, if they were looking fine and good as far as their retirement goals, they still are. They're not that far off. They may need to tighten certain things or do certain things, but in general, they're still looking like they're on track to meet their goals or their retirement goals. Again, one way always for us, and we would, again, encourage, if you want us to help you look at your cash flow and run through those analysis for you, we're more than happy to do that, and that may take some of the anxiousness out of what's going on with the markets. And so, again, stay the course. That's what most of our clients are doing, and then continually stay with the plan. Hopefully you're on track before and should still be there, even with all that has happened, John.
Thanks, Dan. And the legislation from the federal government seems to just keep on coming. What are the next components of stimulus, and how should individuals view them? And what are some of the scenarios we are preparing clients for? And then maybe you could touch on taxes as well. So three part question for you, Dan.
Yeah. So let me talk about that, John. So thank you for that question. So I think this happened after our last call, but there was some interim funding to help shore up or add additional money to the Paycheck Protection Program and to some emergency disaster loans for small businesses. The package was about $484 billion because the last package via the CARES Act was exhausted so quickly. So they added additional $310 billion to the Paycheck Protection Program and additional funding. One of the things that the Treasury's been rigorously doing, because it's caused a little bit of a paralysis in the market, is that a lot of small businesses are afraid to use the funds because there's a lack of clarity as to if they don't use the fund for certain things, they may be penalized or have to pay that money back. There are also obviously issues that were well publicized about certain companies like our Los Angeles Lakers getting relief funding and the bad publicity around that. So all this clamor has caused a little bit of paralysis in the market. So Treasury's been very busy trying to provide additional guidance. They came up with some safe harbor rules today regarding loans under $2 million. So they're actively trying to do that and continue the money that flows in. As far as the phase four, and Rick mentioned that briefly about another stimulus package, many of you know that the House Democrats put on the floor the HEROES Act, and which would include additional stimulus payments to individuals, $1,200 per person, up to $6,000 per household, and $1 trillion going to state and local governments that Rick mentioned is badly needed by state and local governments. But the likelihood and what we're hearing is that will likely not pass and not get through, at least through the Senate. What's interesting today, John, you probably saw this with Jerome Powell's comments, the Federal Reserve Chairman's comments about needing additional capital and needing additional stimulus. So where that goes, we'll see. Will there be need for additional stimulus? A lot of people think there is. We'll see how far it goes and where it ends up. But all the discussion about stimulus and added funds into the marketplace does lead to down the road. And again, this funding is needed. Obviously, our economy is in a crisis, and we need this type of funding to help support people and help people in small businesses alike. But down the road, after this is all done, the question then becomes is how do we pay back and how do we pay for all the stimulus that goes on or has gone on? And so it's hard to not think down the road. And, John, you and I have probably had this discussion quite a bit about it, not thinking or really seeing how taxes don't go up in the upcoming years. You got to pay this back. I guess theoretically, you continue to run huge deficits, but the amount of stimulus that's gone on in the market, you would think needs to be offset somewhere. And the easiest place, obviously, is taxes. And I was thinking through this too. Most tax bills or tax legislation are passed at the very last moment at the end of the year. So let's presume, and again, just an assumption, I'm not making a political call by any means, but let's assume Vice President Biden gets elected, you probably won't see any kind of tax legislation till the end of 2021, I would think, and whether or not that would retroactively apply to 2021 or just to 2022 would be interesting at that point if they would do that. So those are the things to think of going forward, and that's why as we look at planning opportunities and discussions that we're having with our clients is discussing things like Roth conversions and the idea of maybe converting some of your IRA now into a Roth to take the tax hit now to avoid maybe a larger tax hit in the future and allow those funds to grow tax-free. You also have the added benefit of possibly some of those IRA account values being a little depressed because of the current market conditions. So that would result in less taxes on the conversion. The other thing that we talk a lot about our clients who were taking RMDs, required minimum distributions, from their IRAs is because now you don't have to take required minimum distributions, you could consider maybe converting that amount that you normally would take as RMDs to a Roth. And that'd be a great idea and strategy going forward. Because in the past, if normal RMDs are required as it is in most years, you would have to take that amount first. And any additional amount you want to convert, you would take on top of your RMDs. And that normally results in a significant tax hit and something most clients don't want to do because of that. This year, though, because RMDs are suspended, and again, this unfortunately will only apply if you're the owner of an IRA, so not inherited IRAs. It only applies to IRAs if you own or inherited from your spouse. But if you have one of those accounts, maybe it is a good idea to take the withdrawal, do a Roth conversion this year of that amount, because next year, again, you would have to take your RMDs first before you can convert any amount. So those are the kind of things we're looking forward. But, John, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about that, about it's always hard to tell crystal ball what taxes will look like in the future, but it's hard not to see some form of taxes going up.
Yeah, I think we'd all agree on that. And Rick, before I get to the last question, the deficit, I think Fed Chairman Powell today said, let's not worry about the deficit right now. The focus is on the economy. But I think one of, it seems like even though the deficit, obviously, they're talking about trillion-dollar packages here, stimulus packages, but the cost of the debt isn't that significant right now with interest rates being as low as it is. And maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, so borrowing costs have never been more attractive for our federal government. But the thing is, given the way economics work, you know, the government's, their expenditures are up, but their receipts are way down. So if we look at just announced yesterday, government receipts, partly because they rolled out the filing deadlines from April 15th to July 15th, but individual or total tax receipts by the federal government are down almost 55% this April versus April of last year. Although they are better fiscal year to date, September, they're now down 9.7. But so they're getting squeezed on both ends. The thing is, with the deficit that was going to exceed $1 trillion anyway, which is a huge figure, now the thing's going to be over $3 trillion. And so this will put the federal budget or the federal debt level to about 107% of our gross domestic product, which means it will exceed the highest level ever achieved, and that was back in World War II. So the amount of federal debt in private hands is going to be the highest in our country's history. And as Dan said, higher taxes are in our future, period. It doesn't matter who's in office. It's just probably whether it's sooner rather than later. So I would expect the Democrats' proposals to come out to raise taxes to the wealthy taxpayer sooner, and Trump may defer it. But I think the levels of debt that the government has is unsustainable. The other thing, with question that we didn't bring up here, is there inflation in our future? And currently there is no inflation, and we just had a CPI come out negative, which one would expect given the extraordinary nature of this downfall. But that being said, even though we came out of 2008, in the last decade, we didn't have inflation. This time could be different. There's a lot of money that's been printed and put out there, and one would think that eventually inflation comes back. But to remind our clients that if one way to for the government to get itself out of this extraordinary level of debt is inflation actually helps bail them out, because it increased government revenues typically, and the value of those existing government bonds outstanding can decline significantly, so which would give them the ability to refinance some of them if they wanted, and take them off at lower prices. But right now there's no indication that inflation will be a threat for the foreseeable future at this point. But
yeah, thanks, Rick. And with the 10-year Treasury, you know, at literally 0.5%, it's as you said, it's very cheap for the government to issue debt right now, and they're doing it in a significant manner. So that is the one I guess if there's a positive or a silver lining is they're able to issue the debt at next to no cost right now. So, Drew, let's wrap up with some specifics about the recovery ahead. There's a lot of talk about the shape of the recovery. Maybe, Drew, you can help us understand the various scenarios. We oftentimes hear the V-shaped, U-shaped, W-shaped, the swoosh, and provide what your thoughts are with respect to the shape of the recovery and that we can expect. And maybe, Rick, you could add to his comments afterwards.
Great. So I think first things first, it's extremely difficult to predict the exact shape of the economic recovery, just given all the unknown variables still out there. I mean, the fact that we're just beginning to reopen our economy domestically and the markets, you know, the past few days is saying we need more transparency and how successful is that going to be. And then, you know, looking at the odds of what happens if we do see another wave of infections in the fall that would require another shutdown. So right now, a lot of shapes still being thrown out there. And here's how I kind of view the shapes. I guess maybe starting with the V, you know, V for victory. In this scenario, you know, we would see negative GDP in the second quarter, a flat third quarter, and then a strong rebound, and we're back to the races in early 2021. I think many investors early on were hoping for a V for victory shaped bounce back, just given the severity that we saw for the decline. But we're now realizing that a new normal is probably going to be the reality. So this is a pretty low probability. I like to think of as unhurried. You know, the bridge to the other side is a bit longer. We got negative growth extending into the third quarter and possibly, you know, just flat for a while, and then slowly recovering as monetary and fiscal policies gain momentum. My personal take is the U-shaped recovery really means that, you know, we get back to, you know, levels of economic activity, you know, at the end of 2021 or even early 22. So we're talking, you know, 15 to 24 months possibly. Just thinking about what is normal. Do you want to fly in the middle seat of a packed plane? Do you want to go visit Disneyland without any restrictions? So I think that's right now, U for unhurried. W, I think of as whipsawed, two steps forward and one step back. So an environment where things look okay, we're starting to recover, and then due to another flare-up or outbreak, we see, you know, consecutive quarters of depressed growth. So this is an environment that I would say would look more like a double dip recession or multiple dip recessions where the economy really can't get any traction. Then lastly, the swoosh, or as I think of it also as the L shape, is kind of the long-term, grind. So this is almost the worst case scenario, where it's basically negative to flat for a long period of time. And would be associated to basically a depression type environment with very little growth or no growth or benign growth. So ultimately, it's still early, but I think our base case still remains that we see a U-shaped recovery, just given the amount of monetary and fiscal policy that we've seen so far. I like to visually think of it as a valley, where we saw the fastest decline in history for equity markets, historic unemployment numbers, and just a tremendous amount of growth destruction, followed by what we're going through right now. And trying to get to, is the amount of unprecedented fiscal and monetary policy acting as a bridge for the economy to get to the other side. So right now, the S&P 500 basically has priced in a U-shaped recovery, if you think about it, down about 11% for the year. And basically what it's saying is that if you look back at the record highs that we saw in February, we're about 11% less valuable. The companies were 11% less valuable than they were prior to the COVID-19. And this is on the heels of a year where in 2019 we saw the S&P 500 return over 31%. So markets are still looking forward. I think U-shaped is going to probably be the most likely scenario. And I think something like the odds of 60%+ of economists actually polled believe that the U-shaped recovery is probably the most likely scenario. There's one last thing I want to note. I heard some of the programs that were mentioned earlier from the Fed is the Fed actually hasn't even begun some of their monetary programs. So their Main Street lending program, which they promised to fund up to $600 billion, hasn't started yet. The Muni bond program hasn't started yet, and that's about $500 billion. The asset-backed program, better known as TALF, at a tune of $100 billion, hasn't started yet. And the only one that really has started is the corporate bond program, which is targeted for $750 billion, and that's only just started. So what we've seen in the past is when the Fed announces these programs, the market starts to firm up a little bit. But once they actually go in and start purchasing the assets, we start to see the market kind of heal some more.
Thanks, Drew. Rick, do you have anything to add to that?
I would agree with many of the comments Drew said. I differ a little bit on the U-shaped. I gave the scenario that this is a down quarter, and third, we find our bottom at the end of this quarter and the beginning parts of next quarter, but third quarter solidly higher, fourth quarter higher. But I think people need to realize that when we talk about U-shaped or any of these shapes, I don't think any of the scenarios get us back to where we were for quite some time. So Drew mentioned end of 2021, and I think that's a reasonable time frame, if not extending into 2022 to reach our previous high. That's going to be very difficult for us to achieve at this point. But keep in mind, if you have positive economic growth in third and fourth quarter, the direction is going to be really important to us in that we're climbing out of this. So the magnitude, although it would be better, the stronger, I think we need to focus on, are we moving ahead in terms of economic growth? Is it, in fact, positive for us? The W scenario where we have a second shutdown, that is, in my opinion, the worst-case scenario. That is where the virus comes back with a vengeance and we have to shut down for a second time, because now the problem is our government doesn't have the bullets or quite the ammo at its disposal that it did this time, the first time around. So I think it's important we get it right. The problem with this virus or any virus, they typically never leave us, right? So this virus is going to be with us this year, next year, the year after, and 5 years from now, it's still around. It's just whether or not there's a vaccine that's effective enough to allow us to go back to our old behavior. But parts of the world may not have access to that vaccine for a very long period. So there is likely to be, troubled spots throughout the globe for quite some time to come. But in that W scenario, if we head down lower again because we have to shut down again, that would be our worst-case scenario, and hopefully it doesn't come to that and we can get it right this time around.
Thank you, Rick. And this concludes our Wealth Management Insights conference call. We want to thank everyone for taking the time today. As a reminder, replays of this call and past calls are available on our website. And if you have any questions about anything we discussed today or want to discuss your financial situation in more detail, please reach out to us. On behalf of Rick, Drew, Dan, and the entire team, I want to thank you and have a great day.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.